You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yan.
It'd be detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm paying attention to an unlawful assembly.
When we look back at landmark moments that we've all read about, the marches, the court victories, the lives lost, it seems so clear.
In our hearts, our love is equal. The four words.
Is a decision of the United States Supreme Court.
But when you're in the midst of history in the making, as we are now, understanding what's going on is really hard. So after nearly 2 years of living in the COVID-19 tunnel, there's no question that our world will never be as it was. Rapid change is everywhere, and it's not going to stop.
Out of control. The defendants being congratulated as the verdict not guilty rang through the packed courtroom over and over again.
And at some level, I think we're all probably asking ourselves the same thing. What's on the other side? Of course, there's no way of knowing, and this is why the question is so unsettling. I try to remind myself, though, that disruption can be a catalyst for growth, for new ideas and perspectives. So this week, we're airing a program that was recorded live for World Affairs back in March about the Changemaker Effect. It was hosted by Rachel Miro. She's KQED's senior editor for Silicon Valley, and she starts by taking us back to another moment of massive transformation.
Every presidential campaign is marked by speeches and images that stay with us long after the ballots are tallied and field offices are shuttered. But one from recent memory stands out as particularly historic.
And that is why, in the shadow of the old state capitol, where Lincoln once called on a house divided to stand together, where common hopes and common dreams still live, I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for president of the United States of America.
The one-term senator from Illinois was young and inexperienced and running during one of the worst financial downturns in our nation's modern history. But his message was simple and clear. Change.
We were far behind. We always knew our climb would be steep.
But I also knew this. I knew that the size of our challenges had outgrown the smallness of our politics. I was convinced that Americans of every political stripe, that they were hungry for new ideas, new leadership, a new kind of politics.
In record numbers, you came out and you spoke up for change. And with your voices and your votes, you made it clear that at this moment, in this election, there is something happening in America.
And for a brief moment, on a cold November night in 2008, it felt like the nation was united.
If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer.
Obama's campaign inspired pop art and pop music and took root in the earliest days of Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube.
I think a lot of times people come to this and think, well, the Obama campaign was innovative for its use of technology, you know, its use of social media. He was obviously a gifted speaker.
Henry DeCio was the chief operating officer for Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign and served as deputy assistant to the president in the Obama White House.
But the reality was is that, and it may not have been apparent from the very earliest days to the public, but really innovation was a function that developed from a system that came about over time where we really encouraged everyone to step into their own leadership.
His recent book, Changemaker Playbook, The New Physics of Leadership in a World of Explosive Change, explores how individual agency, technological advancement, and the democratization of leadership are influencing our society. We discuss the 2008 campaign, a shifting leadership paradigm, and the pandemic silver lining, and we took a few questions from the live Zoom audience. Here it is in its entirety. Hello, everyone, and welcome to World Affairs. I'm Rachel Miro, senior editor for KQED's Silicon Valley Desk. Our guest today is Henry DeCio Jr. He was chief operating officer for Barack Obama's 2008 run for president. You likely remember all those posters with Obama and the word change. Well, that was a defining theme of the campaign. And that's when DeCio first took notice of an emerging pattern for societal change that we'll be talking about now. Henry DeCio, welcome to World Affairs.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, take us back to your arrival with the 2008 Obama campaign. What did they want from you? How did you deliver?
Well, for me, it was actually a surprise. You know, it's funny, I got a call on December 26, 2006, so the day after Christmas. My wife and I were living on the East Coast, but we were here in California visiting family on the Central Coast. I remember being in a Barnes & Noble bookstore and, you know, spending that Christmas gift card. And I had a call come through on my Motorola Razr flip phone, just to give you a little context of where we are in time. And it was someone asking if they could circulate my resume into the Obama campaign. I didn't know anybody there at the time. But I was asked, you know, what's your vision for how we could do this? And I remember saying this based on some experience I'd had back in 2004 with a team working on in labor, at the FL-CIO. Said, I know that with a computer, an internet connection, and a cell phone, we can turn people's kitchen table into a precinct office, and we can turn that garage into a staging location, a canvassing location. So I thought I had some pretty good ideas, you know, and I shared that. And the campaign manager asked, what do you think of Henry's ideas? And he said, well, they seem interesting. And I thought, Rachel, that was a good thing, except I didn't hear from them for 6 weeks. So this conversation was in early January. In mid-February, I saw him announcing on TV. And I said to my wife, well, it looks like that train has left the station without us. But then in the coming days, I came to Chicago. I was evaluating staff. That's what I thought I was doing. It turned out I think they were evaluating me. And the rest is history. I came in and at the very earliest days and had an amazing experience. It was a great run.
Talk to me a little bit about how you kind of took this different approach to leadership in the Obama campaign.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a great question, because when everyone stepped into their own leadership, there was a different way of getting things done, particularly in the lower and middle rungs of the organization. People worked across those old silo boundaries to bring people around opportunities and challenges. And I say now that it is really the ability to tear down walls and bring people together around challenges and opportunities. That's really when innovation happens. So you would have seen it in our case that certainly technology helped. MyBarackObama.com was a vehicle to bring people together in a different way than any campaign before. And certainly when teams come together, technology might be a result, right? We need an app for this. But what I think happened was we built a system where we were constantly tearing down walls and bringing people together. And that really was what fueled, I think, the Obama movement back from 2007.
So explain for us, you know, is what you're talking about really everybody down to the lowest rung on the ladder, everybody being a leader? Or is team-driven leadership really just a euphemism for people down the hierarchy making themselves comfortable with smaller decisions while the big decisions still happen, I don't know, in a cigar smoke-filled room with just a handful of people on hand?
Well, maybe I can give a little more context, too. So, you know, we started out, I think, despite the innovative nature we projected, we really started out siloed and hierarchical because, again, he announced in mid-February, and it was the first week of April before we actually opened up the doors to headquarters. We had the 11th floor of a downtown high-rise in Chicago. And so you can imagine we didn't know each other at that point. We kind of know some names on email and different things, but you open those doors and people are spilling out onto the floor, and you've got immediately computers are being ripped out of boxes, even as we're still putting the last touches on our servers. You've got checks coming in the mail. We still don't have bank accounts ready to receive them. We've got, you know, no signage on the walls. The phone calls are coming to the reception desk, but they don't know where to send them because we don't know each other's names. So we have no rules, no norms, you know, no cultural history to guide us. And in that sort of environment, then you're building the airplane in mid-flight. And we did grow up siloed and hierarchical because someone gets the fuselage, someone gets the wings, someone gets the wheels. You build it silo by silo. And then you have those silos get harder because you're building systems to execute your functions. Your silo leaders, we call them the department heads, they're coming from the morning meeting, which is sort of like, here's what we're doing, and everybody brings it back to their silo. And you're evaluated as a leader based on how well you keep work out, and how well you keep morale up. So it's very permission-based. In my case, Henry, can I open an office? Henry, can I spend this money? Henry, can we hire staff? All of us at the top of those silos are sort of dealing with the sort of the demands that are pushing us down. And that worked to get us caught up. So we did have a very siloed hierarchical sort of structure. But as we got settled and as the campaign really got going, the speed of change is speeding up. This is a cage match, a competition with the other candidate. You have the hot spotlight of the media constantly trained on your organization. You've got PR crises just always a moment away. So then as problems are outpacing solutions, that one leader at a time siloed system is not working. You have to open it up to let everyone step into their leadership. And to answer your question, it really doesn't become everyone the leader. It becomes everyone a leader. So everyone's got to be able to see the big picture and advance solutions for the overall good of the organization. It's just a different sort of, it's not that we didn't go flat, Rachel, but we basically shifted the way we manage the organization.
You know, I over the years have worked alongside some pretty big egos. I'm going to imagine that you've worked alongside even bigger egos, especially in politics. And oftentimes those egos, the only thing that's holding them in check is their position within the hierarchy. How do you switch to a team leadership model without freeing a bunch of these egos to engage in chaos making?
Yes. I mean, look, this wasn't my preferred model. I should say that right up front. You know, campaigns are risk averse. We don't want problems. We want to keep any problem that comes up confined to the candidate. So you don't want your organization to be causing any trouble for your candidate. But I would just say that there were a couple things that were at work. Number one, as soon as we came in, when we had no form at all, there were three pieces of guidance that came from the candidate that I really think were important in setting the tone, the cultural tone for the organization. Build it from the bottom up, which I think is a sort of a precursor to everyone leading and stepping into their leadership, right? Respect everyone. So now you have, you're now building the elements for empathy and collaboration. And the famous one, which is no drama, right? Which is check your ego at the door. And in essence, like we all then had to be committed to the overall mission of the organization, not to our own egos. It's very clear, Rachel, we come in with our elbows very sharp. We all, you know, have some vision of what we can do for this candidate coming in the door. But we very quickly moved into a very much a team of teams sort of a system where everyone is collaborating across the different silos to advance each other's success, which ultimately goes to the organization's success.
So how does this flipping the physics of leadership on its head, as you've called it, how does this differ from Tony Hsieh's vision for leadership, like the one he outlined in his book, Delivering Happiness, about Zappos?
What happened was, for me, you know, what I realized is that we had two systems sitting side by side over 21 months. We started out siloed hierarchical, one leader at a time. We moved into everyone leading in every moment. And what I found out was that as we shifted from one to the other, it wasn't like a staff meeting. This is sort of like we were kind of pushed into this. We also had, I think, the personality for it as well. But what I started to realize is that the physics, in my experience, the physics of leadership were polar opposites in these two systems. In the old system, one person big, everyone else small in any moment. In this new system, we need everyone to step into their bigness. In the old system, teams organized by functions and jobs. In the new system, people working across those old boundaries to pull people in. For every problem, a department in the old game. In the new game, for every problem, a different team. You have information on a need-to-know basis in the old game. Everyone has to have all the information to act. So transparency is a premium. Permission-based. Now you're moving to trust-based because it's too hard to keep up as rulemakers with all the change that's going on. If you look at every authoritative voice, storytelling voice, coaching more in this new system. So everything was that I knew about leadership was flipped on its head, moving from one system to the other.
So then what happens in this model when you have team members really substantively disagreeing over really big things. You know, I want to decaf in the coffee maker, but I fundamentally disagree with this other guy's strategic vision for what we need to do here.
There were moments when that happened, and really it does come to how the different players position their leadership in any moment. So when we had a crisis, for example, we had a few of those. It wasn't like everybody stepped up and tried to solve the crisis. If you had external PR crisis, he had something come up around his pastor and his church, for example, there is an external issue that's going on. But even as that was happening, we actually had sort of a stock market collapse internally. I remember the day our leading grassroots fundraiser came to me and said, the money has stopped. We've got a problem. So now this is a moment where stepping into your leadership, people in management have to step up. Everyone else has to step back. That happened very naturally. There are some who are dealing with the external PR moment, frankly, opportunity. There are those of us who are trying to make sure to calm people inside, make sure we're still hitting our fundraising targets. So it wasn't a thing where everybody crowded around the ball. It actually turned out that everybody started to find their positioning whenever there was a moment. I think what happened was the organization was really working in flow all the time.
Today's workplace, and I think this is true for companies and nonprofits and arts organizations all over the country, we're working alongside all kinds of generations, right? You know, from boomer to Gen Z for the most part. Is this present and really future that you're envisioning impossible for baby boomers to accept on a big scale or to feel welcome in?
Mm. I don't think this is a challenge for baby boomers. Here's what I think is happening. So there was one big discovery, I think, that can maybe to set up an answer to your question. When we moved from one leader at a time to everyone leading at every moment, you would have thought that we would have wrestled those change forces to the ground. Everybody's on this now, right? The reality is that change not only got faster, it became more explosive and more omnidirectional. Why? Because leaders make change. That's what they do. And if everything you change changes everything, and everyone is doing it, then you're in an everyone a change maker system, which is different from that siloed repeat your skill faster and faster system. And what happens is change is not only faster, but it's explosive, it's omnidirectional, it's a polar opposite system from the old system. When I came out of the White House, I realized that the world had now made this pivot to everyone a change maker. We now had rising individual agency. We had the tools at our fingertips, you know, these phones that we have today, that were the tools of change at our fingertips that were once available to the few are in everyone's hands. And we have democratization of leadership. So that change maker effect that I discovered in the campaign is the change maker effect in the world. Now, what does that mean to get to your question? If you see that we're in a new game, then I think all of us will calibrate into that new game. The problem is that we don't really see this change as clearly as I did in my campaign laboratory. And so we think something is happening. But I think whether you're a boomer, whether you're Gen Y, Gen Z, it doesn't matter. We have a whole generation coming up that is oriented to change. Obviously, younger people are wired for change. Here's the problem. We still gave them the old playbook for the old world of repetition. And then those of us who are at the higher end of the spectrum, we still have both our feet and still see the old game, even though we're in the new game. So we have a perspective problem that's going across the board.
You know, you had a phrase you used in the book that rang frightfully true for me, the shelf life of expertise. It's not so easy to pry people's hands off the pride they take in their expertise. I spent years learning how to do this very thing you're telling me that is completely irrelevant now, you know, like, and also so many of us feel or fear that that's what hiring managers are looking for. Maybe not you, Henry, but other hiring managers.
I think we're intuiting this change. So that's why it's not so clear. But if you look at where hiring managers are talking about where the gaps are, the gaps are in empathy, co-creative teamwork, all the things that employers are looking for. The challenge today is the old soft skills are now the new hard skills. Remember, polar opposite worlds. But I actually think that we all have this, but we've actually been told not to have it. So now what you're starting to see is employers putting a higher premium on the changemaker skills of empathy, being able to see the big picture, how my change is affecting your change, doing that in a responsible way, so not sort of going rogue with your change. Then you have co-creative teamwork, the ability to tear down walls and bring people together. That is now becoming a highly valued skill by employers. Everyone on the team stepping into their leadership, no one being passive. Again, self-permission. This is something that hiring managers are wanting more and more of. And then putting your changemaker, your talents, to work for the good of all, for the good of the mission, that responsibility, that ethical responsibility, they just haven't been able to articulate it because, again, we don't see the new game so clearly as, frankly, I feel like I do based on my experience. But as we see this new strategic landscape, it's a changemaker world. What are the skills you need to have for it? Empathy, teamwork, this new kind of leadership, and putting your change-making to work for the good of all. I promise you, those skills, once we can articulate this better, are just really going to pop out.
But Henry, I'm sure there are many women in the audience who would tell you that empathy is a feminized value in our society, which is to say it's a devalued skill set in our society and in our workplaces. How do we get men and women to value empathy as a feature of leadership?
Right. Well, look, I start by saying, let's just first see this new game so we understand how this really works. Again, the old game, you didn't really need empathy. You just needed a skill, the expertise you're talking about. You needed that and just enough empathy to kind of get along in your system. In this new system that we're in now, the Everyone a Changemaker system, it's more team of teams focused, not functionally teams focused. So you've got to be able to work fluidly across systems. You've got to be able to tear down walls and bring people together. And number one, the act of tearing down walls is a skill that requires empathy. When people come together that are, you know, opposite sides that wouldn't otherwise connect, that's a skill that requires empathy. So I see how as the landscape pivots, we have to pivot with it. Everybody has to have these skills. Every single person has to have these skills. And so my experience is that in my old game, I needed an authoritative voice. I needed to point the way and have other people follow. 2020 vision was the valued leadership skill. But if I took that same sort of approach into the Everyone a Leader system that we evolved into, those leaders fell away. That voice did not work for me. That whole idea of like telling people what to do in a much more collaborative voice, I would have been totally out of step. So it became, it just became a natural progression. And frankly, I like it a lot better. A storytelling voice. What's your story? What's my story? How do these things connect? How do we coach each other through this, not sort of tell each other through this? It just frankly works better. And I think as society makes this shift and businesses and our organizations and our communities see this shift, I think we're going to value this a lot more from everyone, and we're going to crowdsource into this new game.
So this gets us, to the need for empathy skills training in schools, doesn't it? I mean, like, my sense of it is we're still pretty much teaching to tests. We're still pretty much teaching to encouraging, skill sets, but not emotional skill sets.
So one of the examples I always just say, imagine you're a football player and you're getting ready for the big game and you've prepared your whole life for this game. Get on the big pads, that thickly padded helmet. You charge out to meet the other players. Break through that tunnel, the light at the end. You go toward the players. You hear the hum of the fans and the whole thing. But then you see, like, something's changed here. There's not these two spires on each end of the field. There's these two nets. And the players don't have the same heavy gear that you have. They have flowing hair and light clothing that helps them, supports their nimble movements. And they're chasing after this football that spins out a black and white pattern across the ground. The game has changed. So what do you do when the game you've prepared for your whole life has changed? Well, you might be frozen and you'll get pushed to the sidelines, right? The other thing is you might double down on what you know, which is tackle those players to the ground in the flowing hair and light clothing, and that's going to make you dangerous and worrisome. Or to your point, you're going to get new skills. You're going to have to exercise new muscles, take off that heavy gear, get a new playbook because the old playbook won't work in the new game. You need a new rule book. As I started to look at preparing children for this new game, I started to look at the world's leading change makers. And what I found was the skills and tools that they had that prepared them as change makers were just what you said, empathy. At a young age, helping build that empathy muscle before 7, hugely important. Learning around your passion in your preteens, all the things you can learn. You can learn a lot around soccer, even if it's math or learning how to interview, you know, use an iPhone and put it on Apple TV. So you can get public speaking skills. Then in your teams, changemakers typically had an idea and put a team of co-creators and collaborators around that idea in their pre-teens. So now, what does that mean for the educational system? But also, what does all this mean for our workplace, how we develop employees? What does this mean in how we live and work together in our communities? All the things that you have to value now in this new game are going to have to be integrated into all of our systems. So I love your point.
Well, I'm going to engage in a little exercise in the conversation. And along those lines, I'm going to start by asking you, Henry, if you're familiar with the Maynard Institute's fault lines training. Basically, in a nutshell, excluding family, come up with a list in your head, the six top people in your life, other than family, that you trust implicitly. So, you know, just come up with that list. I'll give you a couple seconds here. And
just so I'm clear, so names of people.
Six people in your life who you trust implicitly, who you're not related to. You could technically include your spouse, but I'd say try to reach beyond that. And then once you've got that list, more or less, now you consider all of them, their race, gender, sexual orientation, generation, geography, and class. And the challenge here is to ask yourself how many of these people on your list are exactly or almost exactly like you along these factors. I know they are for me. I'll tell you straight away. I'll admit it right out. It's shocking how many of them are almost exactly like me. And you can see, I guess the question I'm leading to, Henry, is you can see how this would be a problem when it comes to leadership.
Yeah, I think that's the challenge is in the old game, we did sort of bunch up based on our skill set, our educations, those kinds of things. And so you're right. When I talk about, and I'm looking at my list, I completely agree with you. One of the first things that I think we have to look at is that the requisite new leadership skill is to be able to tear down walls and to bring two or more sides together that wouldn't otherwise connect. That's now the requisite in the new game. And frankly, you know, it wasn't in the old game. For whatever reason, it just wasn't. But I always say that the first walls are in our heads. So that does mean that this is like a personal exercise right off the bat.
You know, to me, it just strikes me that team building is something that can only work to its full advantage when companies really have true diversity.
Absolutely. And so I think we're going to find, again, these values are going to change. One of the real challenges that we have now, and it kind of goes even back to your education example. Look, when my kids were in kindergarten, they're 13, so they're going pretty far along. But I do remember having this conversation when they were in kindergarten. And I do remember the whole idea that that 65% of jobs that kindergartners would assume at 16 wouldn't exist yet. And yet we still had our kids on the assembly line to everyone a vocation. And so a lot of what we have in the world right now are systems, mindsets, incentives, frameworks that are built for the world of repetition that goes back to the early farm of the 1600s, the craft of Ben Franklin, the assembly line of Henry Ford, you know, madmen who have been helping us squeeze the last bit of efficiency out of repetition. So your point is really well taken. We have all these vestiges from the old game that we have to throw away and get into this new game. And that is going to mean, how do we work with people who are not like us? How do we build an organization that is diverse and brings in all perspectives? Because again, the old game was about 2020 leadership. The new game is about 360 leadership. This is the new requisite for this new game. It would have been nice if we could have gotten there in the old game. We have to get there in this new game.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. We're tuning into a conversation with Henry DeCio and KQED's Rachel Miro. Henry was the chief operating officer for Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. He drew on those experiences for his recently published book, The Changemaker Playbook, The New Physics of Leadership in a World of Explosive Change. If you missed any part of this episode or want to catch up on other international stories, you can download our podcast. Just search for World Affairs. That's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Back to our conversation with Henry and Rachel, where they start with a question from the live Zoom audience.
An anonymous attendee asks, can you please talk about some specific change makers who inspire you most, and what specifically inspired you?
Well, look, first I'll give you two. One is a North Carolina mom in 1998 was really worried about that young women being defined by society into society's girl box before they had a chance to find themselves. And so she took 12 girls on a run with the idea that she would mentor them with some programming around how to help build emotional health. So they'd go on a run, think of an issue of the day, talk about it in a storytelling context, and then all the while training for a 5K run, which was also exciting for girls at this age to be able to do. That organization is called Girls on the Run. It was founded by Molly Barker, but it was just started out with 12 girls, scaled into a national movement. Today, there are more than 2 million young women who have grown up living outside what she calls the girl box, happily productive in society. So that's one example of just somebody who in their own context, in their own neighborhood, made a change. Another change maker, by the way, one of the people on my list that you talked about, who I trust a lot, was a mom in Chicago who was really concerned about the eating habits and physical fitness of young people. And she started meeting around her kitchen table with a trained chef who would also advise her on nutritional eating. And what she decided was she wanted basically grow a garden and try to show people how healthy eating could really work. And so she moved to her new neighborhood, tore up the back lawn of her new house. You wouldn't believe it, but there was actually made news stories. People were like wondering what this woman is doing. It happened to be Michelle Obama, who was moving into the White House and tore up that precious backyard of the White House to actually grow a garden and then use that as the backdrop over the next 8 years to talk about and make that the context for how young people can live and grow up and eat healthy and live happy lives. Her program is now called Let's Move, right? So I see how people can take whatever resources are available for them in their moment. The First Lady doesn't have a lot in that office, but she could use her informal authority to make change, just like Molly could. Even as the president had all kinds of formal levers that he was working with, and sometimes the informal levers worked better than the formal ones.
I've heard it said that, you know, oftentimes people from the outside look at a position of leadership and they think to themselves, wow, how much can that person do as a function of sitting in that chair? Versus the person in the chair is often thinking most specifically about what they can't do, the limitations of that role.
Changemakers, though, see possibilities, I think, and the way they do it. Look, in Molly's case, how do you build a program? There's a school fortress. Parents have ideas of, you know, who should be interacting with kids and so forth. With that program built out through systems all over the country with volunteer adults coming together, bringing two sides together, young people, adult mentors, learning from each other. In the case of Michelle Obama, she was constantly bringing different informal actors together. Her chef at the White House actually became a leading policy expert, working, sitting down, bringing his expertise alongside policymakers at the FDA and so forth. Changemakers see possibilities based on bringing people together. And this does get to expertise because actually you can expand your expertise. Why should the expertise of a chef stay in the kitchen when you can actually put that expertise alongside people who are making policy? So that was one of the things that I saw in changemakers that was remarkable, their ability to move ideas out of those silos and help people learn together and get different perspectives together.
What do you say to people who are listening to this and thinking, you know, Henry, I'm halfway down the path of my life and, you know, I'm just not a changemaker. I'm not entrepreneurial. Maybe I'm a cog in a very large machine, or maybe I'm recently retired and, you know, so far outside of any sense of power in my life, I just don't see how what you're suggesting is for me.
I just need to meet those people because I actually don't meet them. If I go to an audience and I say, look, how many of you identify with this? Innovative mind, service heart, entrepreneurial spirit, and collaborative outlook. How many of you identify with that? I have every single hand in the room go up. Now, here's where I find the problem is. Typically, the bigger response I have is, I'm a change maker, but when I go to work, they won't let me be one. I'm a change maker, but when I go to school, they won't let me be one. I'm a change maker, but at home, it's pretty hard for me to be one. Like all those old hierarchical systems start to, and sort of those labels and the things that push us into our smallness come into play. But I don't find people actually living their lives, pursuing lives that don't have to do with those very same qualities. But what I do think the tension is it's very hard for a change maker to go to work in a siloed hierarchical system. It's just not a happy place. It's pretty hard to exist in an environment where you're constantly being pushed into your smallness when you want to be a full contributor. So the reason why this book is resonating is people say, wait a minute, I am one of those things. And now the problem is we've got to get our systems aligned with this new game, because there's nothing worse than playing in the new game with the old playbook. There's nothing worse than playing the new game in the old stadium. It just doesn't work. So we've got to get our systems, our cultures, our mindsets aligned with who we really are and who we're going to be over the next millennia to come. We're not putting this genie back into the bottle. We have a changemaker effect in society. We all have rising individual agency. We do have the tools that allow us to act on change like never before. We have walls falling in society that is enabling the democratization of leadership. We got to get into this new game.
So Henry, you know, I cover Silicon Valley a lot. One of the things we look at is the daylight, the gap, the distance between the rhetoric of some of these companies talking about the empowerment of their workers and the literal truth of those workers' lives. You know, maybe you're a gig worker where your only real control over your work experience is when you clock in, when you clock out, because everything else is decided to a T. Or maybe you're, let's say, a software engineer making 200K plus with Benny's, and you know, you have a lot of choice in the workplace cafeteria, but you don't really have any big decisions, say, about what contracts the company takes on. If you don't like it, well, then you can lump it. You can walk out that door. You don't actually have that much power.
Yeah. It can also be patronizing, right? So it's like, well, you work in this little box and you should innovate in that little box.
Yeah.
First of all, if you're a business person, this business strategic landscape is complicated. It is the changemaker effect on society is creating a very different landscape than what we've ever had before. So if you're in business and we're seeing businesses are failing faster, we're seeing big brands that were prominent for years and years and years just go away. It's very clear now that you have to really see that you're interacting with change makers, and you have to build your business to accommodate that. And so any CEO that is not getting the perspective of every employee in the organization is going to be missing out. And so that doesn't mean everybody's sitting around the boardroom table making the decisions. It does mean that you have to figure out how to bring all perspectives forward, because everyone in the organization now has a stake in the success of your organization like never before. And you need values alignment. So I always say that the new KPI for any CEO right now in a changemaker world is how many of our people are changemakers. Because you're going to have changemakers to be able to interact with that. And how would you build your organization differently if you understand this? For example, if you're a teacher and you see change makers coming into your classroom instead of students, how would you build your classroom differently? If you are a business person, an executive, and you see change makers coming through your doors and not consumers, how would you build your organization differently? How does this work for government leaders? If you saw change makers in your community and not taxpayers, how would you build that differently? So now we're in a time now where all perspectives matter, but you're also, again, you're dealing with a universe now, innovative mind, service heart, entrepreneurial spirit, collaborative outlook. These are not consumers anymore. This is a stakeholder base for you. These are your partners in moving your mission. To your point, if you say one thing in this changemaker world where we have full transparency and you're doing another, if there's not an alignment between creed and deed, on the campaign trail, that's a crisis. So in this new world of full transparency, that's a business crisis.
Let's talk a little bit more about politics, because I think, you know, certainly I've observed on the one hand, people tend to be very critical about politicians, right? For good reason sometimes. I think there's a lot to be cynical about in the past, in the present, and probably the future. But I can also empathize with somebody considering going into politics, whether it's at the highest level or, you know, just running for school board in your local community. It's like an acid bath. The hate that comes at you, the level of expectation, the disappointment, right? It's really hard to please people, and it's hard to convince people that they have a stake in participating in what a different future might look like. There's a tendency to say, okay, I just voted you in. You fix it. You make it better, like right away, because in about, 30 seconds, I'm going to blame everything on you.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think we're going to find that everything is going to change as this new game comes into more focus for all of us. And we're going to make our political decisions based on that, too. Right now, because this shift in the world, you know, look, it was very clear the change in front of my football player. It's not so clear the change in front of us. So that's why I really put a premium on what is this new strategic landscape, this changemaker world that we're moving into. What does that mean? If I was running for office right now, you know, when you brand yourself, you go out there and you say, well, I'm the war hero one, I'm the tax cutter one, or whatever that may be. If I wanted to connect with my stakeholder universe right now, doesn't matter, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter. Innovative mind, service heart, entrepreneurial spirit, collaborative outlook, that's the opportunity for politicians. You can totally build bridges to create really amazing things if you tap that rather than sort of move into division. But I would argue that if I were running for office right now, I would run as the changemaker one because I think that's what people are moving toward. And that, again, is not a Democrat thing, a Republican thing, left, right, red, blue. There is an opportunity in politics. But again, until we all see that, then politicians are not going to market into that.
So let's imagine, you know, President Joe Biden gives you a call on the telephone and says, I've got a number of really horrendous wildfires I need to put out right now. How am I supposed to employ your principles of management to make my life better and to make everyone else's life better?
Here, I'll tell you the one I hear more than that, which is that stuff sounds really nice, but I've got too many fires to put out. But once I get through those fires, I'll do that really fluffy, nice changemakery thing that you're talking about. And my thing is, if you really want to solve the problems of the world right now, changemakers are the fire extinguisher. So how can you tackle, how can you harness those possibilities that come with a changemaker society, with a changemaker workforce, with all the tools that we have today to really bring about positive change? That's where I stake a flag in the ground. So again, you know, if I were a principal, I would be trying to figure out how to graduate changemakers from my school. If I were a business, I'd be asking why we're not graduating changemakers from that school, because I'm going to need them in my workforce. We look at this pandemic, which has been, you know, just been heartbreaking on so many levels. But there is one sort of sliver of a silver lining here for me. I'm very hope and changeful about this generation coming up, because they are getting the skills of dexterity. They are getting the skills of empathy. They've worked from school. They've gone home. They've worked on computers. They're developing. I think this generation coming up is going to blow us away. So if I'm advising somebody like Joe Biden, I would be tapping into the changemaker effect and really bringing that forward into society today. I would do that if I was talking to Joe Biden or any CEO or any principal or any parent.
So somebody asks, a lot of us are feeling cynical about leaders who say they are change makers, but once they're in power, they seem to just cling to that power.
I don't know. I'm looking for the leaders who say they're change makers. I have not heard leaders say I'm a change maker. There's very few. But I will say this. Again, we go back to this alignment of deed and creed. If in this world today, with all the tools and all the transparency, you used to be able to sort of say one thing. Look, you could hire a communications manager who would, you know, go through comms school, get their degree. They could give you all the messages that you need. You could put them out on the channels that you needed. If you do that today, you're going to fail, because you're going to forget that you have 3,000 employees or 300 employees who have all the same tools that you have now. And they are on Glassdoor, they are on LinkedIn, they're communicating with their friends. I think the one beautiful thing about today's world is if you were to say you were a change maker and you're not, people are going to easily be able to surface that. it's just not going to hold up.
Can you please talk about how to recognize when change is productive and forward-looking versus when it's change for the sake of change?
So I'm not about change for the sake of change at all. But I am saying that change is a factor in our lives and everyone is doing it. The foundation for this changemaker world is empathy, empathy-based leadership, empathy-based ethics. Now, let me give you an example of how it worked for me. I'll pull this back to my campaign laboratory. Boy, in the first 16 months, we grew from zero employees to 2,000 employees. And in those 16 months, we went from, you know, in those early days, $7 million a month to $40 million a month. But when Hillary left the race and we were going to have to go up against, you know, the Republican machine, very, very attractive candidate on their side. And so here we are now are up against some pretty big odds. We would now grow from 2,000 employees a month. Remember, two in the first 16 months to 6,000 employees in the last 16 weeks. And we go from $40 million a month to $100 million a month in the last 16 weeks. For me, how were we going to swallow all this change in this everyone a leader system, this thing that we have going on? Like, I thought for sure, like, I was going to lose the election for my candidate. There was just no way to hold this together. And I started as a rulemaker. I tried to think, well, how can I make enough rules to be able to try to solve this problem? The reality was that we basically positioned our team across the organization so that the people welcoming these people in and the people coming in understood this cultural framework we had. Remember, build it from the bottom up, respect everyone, no drama, make sure that you use change responsibly. We didn't have one piece of rogue activity, not one rogue hire, not one rogue office, no purchases that were made rogue. The bottom line was, in this everyone a leader system, empathy really is the cornerstone. And when everyone is a leader, everyone is a stakeholder. And when everyone is a stakeholder, everyone is a steward. And so what we had was people used their change responsibly, and the community moved us to the very end without any of those issues. So again, I think we have to really put a premium on empathy and working to collaboration in this new world that we're coming into. I have to know, Rachel, that you're going to use your change for the good of all, not just for the good of one.
You know, I imagine there are a lot of people, especially now, who are really struggling with the way their company culture has evolved or devolved during the pandemic, when people had to switch to working remotely, or some people had to switch to working remotely and other people had to put their lives on the line. How do you imagine using these tools, either from the bottom up or the top down, to really change that culture, that organizational culture that we're going back to now that people are getting the vaccine?
Well, look, this perspective taking here, but I think we have to really appreciate that we have really tapped into our inner change makers during this past year. We have all had to figure out how to navigate our workplace differently. We've had to work from home while we're also teaching our students. Like, when this all happened for me, my new coworkers were my kids. So we have a co-working space. So how did we have to structure our home differently so that our kids, we weren't the parents of our kids all day long, but literally, like, knowing that they have a teacher that they're accountable to on the one hand, and they're accountable to us on the other hand. How do kids work with two bosses now instead of one at different points in the day? What was happening was all of us have had to learn in our own way how to command this totally disrupted landscape. And we're all innovating in our own ways. The best workplaces now are going to figure out how to take the best of all of our change-making ideas and our capacities forward into this new game. We're not going back to the old way. Anyone who says, let's get right back to where we were, is going to be back in that old game. And I mean, I'll just say this. If I could give one piece of advice to my football player running out onto that field, it would be this: your old team will lose the new game. And if I could give a second piece of advice, it would be your old mindset might actually be the very thing that keeps your team from getting into the new game. So we're all going to have to open up and look at what we bring into this new landscape in a powerful way, not sort of try to put everything back into a tidy box. It won't work.
I suspect I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. One person asks, are some industries more likely to succeed in adopting an everyone leads approach?
I haven't really sat and figured that out. I see this happening in different sort of spaces in different ways. And I guess I'll say this. The bottom line is people don't see the new strategic landscape so clearly. And when they do, I actually do think it's not going to be such a problem. I mean, educators, we have educators who are change makers. I do think that the system that they've inherited that goes back millennia is a system built for repetition. So how do we open up permission for educators to start teaching these values that we think have to happen? Same thing when we go to work in any industry. We've sort of brought this old game forward, and it's like a square peg in a round hole. Remember, these are polar opposite systems. So what I think we should really be thinking about is, are business schools graduating changemakers? Education schools graduating changemakers? Are primary schools putting a premium on the skills that are needed for the new game? Instead of sort of looking at where things will fit best, I mean, I've been in startups that are starting out the old game, and I've been in long established companies that are really open-minded and saying, we got to get into this, and we will do the hard work of trying to adjust our mission and our systems into this new game. But that's a lot of work if you have 40 years of reputation in a certain way of doing things. So I think it's more about how we as a society make the adjustment into this new game. And then I think we're going to start seeing spaces open up all over the place. I think we're on a cutting edge of something, though, because I think what I'm trying to do with my book is say, let's see the new game, and then we'll all get into it in sort of our own way. Might not be as clean as we'd like, but I think it's going to happen. I am very hope and changeful about this, Rachel.
So you mentioned not as clean as you'd like, and that sort of leads me to a question I've been having while reading this book is, you know, the place of failure in this system. We give a lot of lip service, especially in Silicon Valley, to the idea, oh, you know, fail fast, fail often. But the truth is that there isn't a lot of appetite for that kind of risk.
No.
And
of course not.
Oftentimes, you know, it's very difficult for people to say, what happened there? What can I learn from it and move on the way we're sort of taught to in textbooks or YouTube lectures?
Yeah, look, I mean, I sound like I'm really like, this was a very easy thing for me. Look, I grew up, you know, with the whole one leader at a time framework. I mean, I would have probably said going into the Obama campaign, I was an enlightened leader and a mentoring leader. I wanted everyone to step into their leadership. But, you know, I still remember my school books that had that one figure hero. So, you know, somebody had to be in charge in any moment, and that person was the leader, right? And my dad would say, you can either be a leader or a follower. He wanted me to be the leader. He was pretty clear on that whole thing. So again, it is a challenge. Nobody wants to fail. I was going into the campaign. I was very risk averse. You know, we were kind of pushed into this really by the forces of our market. And by the way, that didn't mean every campaign would do that. And what I'm saying here to everyone else is, you know, we're feeling something. We know we're going a general direction, but I'm just saying, why don't you see this game now and get into it like my football player? Because otherwise, there's so much tension that goes on when you don't really lean into that, right? To use a Silicon Valley phrase. But I will say that this is hard because all of our incentives, the way we pay people, the way we give them bonuses, the way we evaluate them and on talent development day a year, right, is how well did you do this by yourself instead of how well did you work across silos? How well did you advance the mission using new ways of working? You know, so we've got a lot of work to do. But once you commit to it, you know it's a learning journey. And you know this isn't a one day, a year development process. This is a daily development process for the individual and the organization as a whole.
Can you give some very specific, everyday examples of staff in the campaign acting as change makers? Some anecdotes that will illustrate your point.
Yeah, very early on, for example, there was a tension in the campaign, I think in the early days, was, is it field or is it online? And so people tried to pit one against the other. Back in those days, is 10, 12 years ago. So online stuff was kind of new. There was this sort of thing with, oh, sure, you know, people get online from their basements and, you know, all that. But what happened was, is that when we allowed people to sort of come together around the issue, what we found was we could marry the work between the online, having sort of like, let's do a day of action where we're integrating door knocking, for example, and action with social media campaigns. And we would test it by based on how much money you could sort of get in contributions at the door and how much you could get online. What we found was is that actually people found the place that suited them. And we didn't spend our whole campaign knocking on doors and raising money. We just started learning about how will this work? Whether we get a pledge at the door, we get a pledge online, how can we start integrating these two forces together? Eventually, what started to happen was we found that our internet community, by valuing it rather than devaluing it, we could actually find that it added a huge contribution to the overall organization. And those two worlds of field, what we called then new media, really came together in a very powerful way. So rather than pick one over the other, people came together and figured out how to make it work so that we all succeeded.
It's interesting you say that. I think whether you're talking about Ocasio-Cortez or others, you know, like people even today, nearly a decade on, still tend to come down on one side or the other and say, you know, like, oh my gosh, the granularity we can get to with online, that's what we got to aim for. That's where success lies. It's all in the data. It's all in the data. And then you have the other camp saying, no, it's, you know, it really is face-to-face, you know, mano a mano, person to person.
Can I add to that point? I love what you're saying. That was the early way we kind of looked at it, right? Like, how can you perform? How can this one perform? Where might we meet? If you fast forward about a year after the Iowa caucus, our new media team was very sensitive to what was going on in the field and vice versa. That team, the new media team, again, I'm using the term of the time, they started surveying across the country who would be willing to open up their homes to field organizers. And so we had about 90 to 100 field organizers in Iowa, and they were going to spread out across the country because of the new media team actually surveying the volunteer landscape. They were able to secure households that our field organizers in Iowa could go to in Nevada, in California, in, you know, Arizona, places like this. So they fanned out. So the field then fanned out across the country and went to the next place. And then new media was figuring out where the next place they could go based on actually just putting it out there. This wasn't a cold request. They had built that online community, that invested community over a course of many, many months. It wasn't just a fundraising juggernaut. These were people who were invested in the organization. So when it came time to make the call to put a field organizer from another state in their home, we literally moved our whole campaign through like the 50 races or 56 races, whatever was going on, really using that marriage between social media and field. But it really goes to that question that goes to the very beginning. Changemakers would not have been able to do that. There would have been a lot of, that's not my job. But everybody was actually always looking for opportunities to advance solutions.
Well, Henry DeCio Jr., what a pleasure talking with you today.
Fantastic. Thank you. I really enjoyed this.
Henry's new book is Changemaker Playbook, The New Physics of Leadership in a World of Explosive Change. Check it out if you'd like to be a changemaker in your world. Thanks again for joining us today, and have a great rest of your week.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there any international stories you'd like us to cover? Please send us an email or a voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Matteo Schimpf and Elise Manoukian. Joanne Jennings is our executive producer. Jim Bennett is the technical supervisor. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Young. Thanks for listening.